Welcome to At a Crossroads with a Naked Podcaster, where we bear it all spiritually and emotionally. I'm your host, Jen Taylor. Each week on the podcast, I'll bring you an inspiring message to support you in designing and creating a vibrant, fulfilling life. Before we dive in, please visit the Facebook community in the links to ask questions that I can answer during this live podcast. At a Crossroads with a Naked Podcaster, for those of you who know that there is more to life and that our true, authentic souls are built for greatness, you are built with strength and love that is meant to shine through in times of conflict and in times of celebration. Welcome. I cannot wait to bear it all with you. In my business, I coach Christian women to step into who they are meant to be, inspired by their purpose and God-given gifts. Find the link in the description to join my private Facebook group. I can't wait to see you there. Let's get started. Woohoo! Hello, Justin and Alexis Black. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having us.
How you doing?
So you can hear me. I'm not having tech difficulties right this second.
Yep. Can you hear us? We hear you good?
Yes! Okay, I'm so excited about this because I should have been put in foster care as a child, and I was involved in foster care for 15 years. So 12 years I was a foster parent, and 3 years I recruited and trained foster parents to work with treatment level foster kids, which here in Nevada means that they've gone through the toughest of the toughest stuff. So I worked with really, really hard, difficult situation kids, kids that were coming in and out of juvie or kids that were coming in and out of mental institutions that were basically, you were the last stop at this point. So I am super excited to have you guys on.
Yes, yeah. We're excited to be here.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, energy level, we love it. We need that, right?
So you guys have, I have a bunch of stuff up, and what I'm going to do is share your Linktree link. Because that has pretty much all the things. So I'm going to share that now. And so people have your contacts. But first, jump in and tell me about the website, about the Facebook group, about the book. I'm so proud of you guys, your published authors.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so we have our book. It's called Redefining Normal, How Two Foster Kids Beat the Odds and Discovered Healing, Happiness, and Love. And actually, so we published the book in November, and since then we've sold about 7,000 copies. We're self-published. We won 9 book awards, and we turned that into our company. So we have a company called Redefining Normal, hence the shirt. And so we develop a workbook. Now we have a podcast, and we do pretty much full-time speaking engagements. So this is what we do pretty much all day, every day. And we were actually also just learned that we are a part of the Forbes Next 1000 class of 2021. So just highlighting 1,000 entrepreneurs across the country, and we got chosen.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Now, have you already started? I'm on your email list. So have you started working on the audiobook, or is that coming, or is that already happened? Where are you at in that?
Yeah. So the audiobook, I mean, it's as far as the work is done, it's a wrap. It's a sticky situation. We're trying to get it out. So we hoping for 2022, we've been making a few progress with just trying to get it out and get it together. We just want to do what we can to get it out, get it to people. And our goal with that is to try to get to people who often don't read, who are super busy, a huge family, a bunch of kids who don't maybe have time for just peace and quiet all the time, but maybe can throw in earphones or something or drive somewhere and listen to audiobooks. So we're trying to get it out for all segments. And it's a huge population of people who listen to audiobooks. We want to try to get our book into their hands or in their ears as well. So
yeah, you guys mentioned in your email that it was pretty emotional. So writing a book is super emotional, especially when you're going back and diving into your past. What was the audio version like compared to the writing process?
Much more difficult.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I feel like I can write things, you know, I can write, you know, anything all day, every day. When we were writing our book, we wrote the entire book together, and a lot of the book, honestly, I really struggled with getting my pieces out. And so I would have to kind of talk to Justin out loud. Like, he was kind of like my counselor in the moment of, you know, this is what happened. This is everything that's going on in this situation. And then he more or less translated my words onto the paper. And so this book would not be where it is today without him being able to literally take my story and write it down. So there were parts of the book definitely difficult to write. But when you say it out loud, it's like I have to, I know it's like it's mine. It's something that I went through. And as much as we try to heal from it or hide from it or, you know, push it away, it's still there and it's still a piece of me. And that makes it incredibly difficult. And so, you know, having to relive a lot of those moments out loud were actually really hard.
I'm an author also, and it was my story. And so I wouldn't have thought the audio would be so much more difficult. So that's super interesting. And I mean, the whole process is hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Getting the story out and doing it well, because what's in your head, getting that onto paper is a really difficult process. So I'm very proud of you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely appreciate that. Thank you.
Tell me about the podcast and the speaking. I mean, basically, you guys wrote the book and it, your life took a completely different turn. So what has that process been like?
I mean, it's as far as the podcast or just the... Since
both.
I mean, first with the podcast, it's called a Rose from Concrete podcast. And it's mainly myself. I'm going to try to drag Alexis on a few episodes. Yeah, so it's basically taking themes and subjects from the book, having more in-depth conversations about those subjects, and inviting other guests on to talk about their story of redefining whatever field or area that they're in as it relates to personal or professional life. It could be one of my favorite episodes is when we invited a friend over and had them talk about they're an art major in college. And you know how people dog art majors about, oh, that makes no money. Why would you spend money, go to college for 40 plus years to be an art major? So I wanted to debunk some myths about that. And then things like that about personal life, about foster parents, foster care, definitions of love, other authors who are writing about cool things in general, and just have these amazing conversations and ask these challenging questions that they don't usually get asked. So is that, but then, it's been so many other things we've been able to do to continue the conversation, like our podcast, our workbook, Ready to Redefine Normal, the youth edition out right now, where people can take our lives out of the book and go through those subject matters that we cover within the book and ask themselves those questions of definitions of love and culture building and community building and definitions of family and so many other things that they're able to ask. And like you said, our life has completely changed since we started this business. And we just did like a keynote speech for 2,000 to 3,000 people in Florida for the biggest child welfare conference in Florida. And we just been, our life has been changed for the better. And it's super busy, sometimes overwhelming and taxing, but I wouldn't want it any other way. And I'm just extremely thankful that we're in this position right now. So,
Yeah, how incredible that you get to, I mean, massively pay it forward. And I know once we get into your story, that will make a lot more sense. What is the goal with the business? I know it's kind of taking twists and turns. You've got the book, the audio, the workbook. We haven't talked about that. And the podcast. What do you see? Do you have a big picture? Are there things that you want to do more of or a direction you want to take it in?
I mean, eventually, I know for both of us, what we'd really like to do is bring more people on our team who are speakers and authors and who have redefined their normal in their own right. And so we're essentially almost creating like our own mini like speakers bureau, to where if people reach out to us to speak, we don't always have to be the forefront of everything. We can have, you know, other people potentially go out and speak and represent the brand and what it is that we talk about. So that's something that we're really looking forward to. And then just developing the brand and this whole ecosystem of healing and growth and generational, or essentially like ceasing generational patterns and things like that. So it's more workbooks coming out right now. The first one is for youth. Then we have several more coming out for Christians, advocates, things like that. And then children's book series and several other things to really just try to build out this ecosystem that we're trying to create. Mm-hmm.
So many different directions. I mean, I wouldn't have even considered the Well, yeah, I guess once we get into the story, we will consider the generational influence that gets had on in families. And I have a funny example of that. There was a couple that got married and she cut the end off the pot roast before she put it in the oven. Have you guys heard this one?
Oh, I heard that story. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we just do weird things because, well, my mom did them or my dad did them and his. And when you go back and look, like the pot roast didn't fit in the great grandmother's oven. You know, I mean, it's just these weird things. And I love the funny stories like that where we see it makes it clear to people that, yes, we take on generational baggage without realizing it. And some of it, a lot of it is not positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. And I love that concept. And I think for a lot of people who've experienced trauma, whether in foster care or not in foster care, you have to understand that it's been passed down. These practices and habits have been passed down for so many generations that mm-hmm. our parents don't even think about how they impacted us. They don't think about, oh, for fathers, I need to be more, tell my son that I love them, or I need to do this for my son. I need to be there for my son, because they're only living the life that they've known for their entire life. And mm-hmm. I think for one thing for I had to realize as an older teenager and a young adult is forgiveness. That my parents, they have their trauma and they have to go through what they go through, but I have to find contentment and happiness for myself, and not for parents who a lot of times just not able to provide that for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's definitely a more adult concept. As a kid, you just feel a little bit more lost. Let's jump back in time now in your story, because we're going to be making a lot of connections. So you guys, either one of you, I know, Justin, you're a little younger.
Not
I also am a cougar, so I appreciate that.
I said almost 4 years, so yeah.
Yes, my husband's 4 years younger too. It's a good cougar thing to. I appreciate it. So, jump in at one. However, you guys want to jump in to go back in time and tell kind of the story.
Yeah, of course. So for myself, I entered the system at 9 years old. I'm from Detroit. And grew up in Detroit since about 18 years old, pretty much my whole life. And I believe I entered the system largely due to mental health issues being neglected and passed down generationally, which resulted into domestic violence in my household with my parents, drug abuse, and just living in communities and environments filled with poverty and neglect. And, you know, 90% or more of youth who enter the foster care system is because of poverty and neglect. So I was one of those youth fulfilling that statistic. And throughout my time, I think mental health has been a huge, just reoccurring theme throughout my life. And especially, you know, not having parental figures who seem to love or care about me, being that they only live like 25 minutes away from me the entire time I was in care in Detroit, but rarely checked in, rarely called. Mm-hmm. And it's just, felt worthless throughout my life, and even more around the age of 13 when a brutal attack happened when I was walking home from school, randomly just hit with a brick, attacked on my way home from school, and lost 6 of my teeth, including my front teeth and a bunch of my other teeth, and had long-term dental health issues until I was about 22, so roughly 2 or 3 years ago. And dealing with that and not having family members who could really understand what I was going through mentally, who, you know, I live with my aunt at the time, who wanted, you know, my family wanted revenge to a degree, but it was more or less my mental health that needed the support and help. So dealing with that throughout my teenage years, young adult years, and going to school without my smile, like as a teenager, was like rough. It was like 10 times like the stress, you know. Now you combine family and parent issues, now that's just even more. So I had to deal with all these things and in the process of trying to understand myself outside of my parents and the culture that they built for me. So going through this process, it wasn't until I was like a young adult getting ready to go to college and be on my own. So I was able to fully realize that, you know, I am a man of God, and that's who I rely on. And that's who I am. And really dig into it was mentors and a bunch of other people who helped me realize that. But it really just took me being alone and by myself and not trying to seek happiness and validation from other people, which you still struggle with to this day. But really going through that process and that realization of, okay, I need to satisfy God, and that's how I receive my validation of who I am, because I'm made in the image of God, and I am who I am because God made me a certain way. So had to go through that process of figuring that out. So. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember a lot before? You said you went into the system at 9. How much do you remember before that? Because I would expect quite a bit.
Yeah, I remember everything, or for the most part, everything. What was crazy is, as we illustrated our, or wrote out our book and everything, is you really don't realize how much you've gone through, because we feel like each section of the book is like a different life. And like my life as a child versus my life as a teenager in the system, versus, it's like different lives really just combined in one. And you don't really think it's real, but throughout, you know, when I was a child, you know, we talk about in the book how things became normal. And that's how, that's why we use that word, redefining normal, and use normal in our business and everything, because the trauma was normal. We were desensitized to certain things, and desensitized to my view of manhood, my view of interacting with women. If I wanted, as an 8-year-old, if I wanted attention from a woman, then I need to smack her on the butt or do something inappropriate to get her attention. And violence as a way to get attention from my family and my siblings, and so many layers of trauma that just becomes normal and it becomes cultural. And that's kind of what was being implemented into me as a child, and as a I would say even as a young teenager, so many things and messages being implemented into my brain as a young child. And that's kind of the life I lived up until I entered the system. And then I started to transform a bit, but still carrying a lot of that baggage and a lot of that worthlessness that I received from the lack of attention from my parents.
When you were 9, you said something about your aunt. Did you go into family placement?
So initially I went into family placement. So when I was 9, I went to live with my oldest brother. At the time, I lived with him for 2 years. And then after I left there, I lived with my aunt for 5 years. And then after I left that situation, I lived with my brother's best friend parents for about, I would say, 8 months, maybe about 8 months. And then I went to live in a group home where I was about 16 or 17. I was 17. I lived there for 2 years before going to college at Western Michigan.
So in that process of your aunt, your brother to your aunts, and all of the places that you went, who or what helped you or made things more difficult in that period of time? And then I want to know what the group home was like for you.
Yeah. So what made things difficult was, you understood as a youth in care that the you don't really have a home, and that once you leave, it's like you kind of are walking on eggshells a lot, because for biological children, a lot of times, you don't, for some parents, you really don't have a choice to keep your biological children. And I know some parents kick their biological children out at 18, like 18 birthday, right? You got to go, which is real unfortunate. But for foster youth, it's like, if I like you, I'll keep you. But if I don't, you know, then you got to go. So for a lot of times, you're walking on eggshells, and these constant threats of, all right, y'all got to go, or, you know, you can't stay here long. Y'all keep doing this, y'all got to go. And all these threats, it's like, what type of living situation, you know, you come home from school and you kind of got to think in the back of your head, like, if I don't get the grades I need, if I don't take care of my chores, if you have all these requirements and standards to where it's like, man, if I don't do it, if I don't meet these requirements and standards, then I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to be without a home. I could be sent to a detention center, or, you know, and it's just like this unfair expectation. I think that's like the hardest piece, when you're like walking on eggshells 24/7 with daily mistakes that teenagers make. Like if you're a parent with biological children, it's, I wouldn't say normal or okay, but it's almost acceptable for them to not sometimes do chores. Like, how many times you have to remind your biological kids to do chores? How many times you have to remind them to, hey, don't hit your sibling, or don't do this, don't do that, don't eat up all the food. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, I'm a foster youth, then, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't forget your chores. But for biological kid or kids who are in their biological family, it's normal and acceptable. So things like that, you just have to figure out as a foster youth.
That makes my heart so sad, because I was a foster parent for 12 years and then trained. And when kids have gone through a lot and they're a teenager like you were, if that child does not want the placement and does not want it to work, it will never work. And I used to tell kids when they were older that came into my house, like, I really want this to work. I don't want you to ever have to go anywhere else. And you can come talk to me about anything. I want this to be the last stop. But if you're not on board with that, like if you sabotage it, I can't make it work if you don't want it to work. And so I felt like I always thought the opposite, but I mean, my biological and adopted kids, we did foster care for so long that foster kids would come in and be like, yeah, she's biological. Mom didn't get to choose her. She chose us, you know, like I wanted the foster kids more than the biological kids because like, she chose me. She didn't know what she was getting with you. Like, you know, so there was
I love that. I never heard that.
And I'm like, some of you grew under my heart and, you know, cause I was pregnant and some of you grew in it, but I don't love you any different. So I'm hearing that from you. I'm really glad at the approach that I took. Like I want it to work. If you don't, I can't force this to, it will not work if you're not on board. And I really want it to. And, you know, but I had a chore wheel. I was hard on everybody equally with that stuff, but I know what you're saying. I understand what you're saying because, you know, if it wasn't working and I had ever wanted to pull the plug on any of those foster kids, I could have. I did have the power to do that. I never went into it thinking about it that way. I thought about it from the opposite way, that the child had a lot more control than I did in making it work. So that's super interesting and makes my heart sad for you.
And that's not to say that I didn't play a role in leaving some of those homes either. You know, I could have done a lot better. I got suspended in school a lot, a bunch of phone calls home. And there were definitely some things I could have improved on, especially when I was living with my auntie. But, you know, I think it goes both ways. I had to take responsibility. Yeah. We both could have done better. But, you know, it is what it is.
I think a lot also is the way you approached it versus a lot of how at least the individuals in that situation, it was almost like, you know, you should be grateful you have a home. So you need to act like it. Oh. More of a situation. And that's the feel that I get from every single time, you know, things are brought up or how it was, how everything's talked about. It's always like, you know, you're in my house, this is my food, this is my home. You're going to respect that. But also you should be grateful that you have a place to sleep.
Those words were said.
Yeah.
I'm so sad because I used to be like, I'm so grateful you're here. And I really want you to never have to move into another house. So
that's how my foster adoptive parents were, you know, they said it like that. I moved in on her birthday and she's like, you're a gift. And I saw it as like, I'm a burden. You know, I'm coming in on your birthday. I apologize. Right. And she was like, don't apologize. You're my gift. You know? So it's changing the narrative. Yep. You have the power to do that as the parent in the situation.
Right. Justin, I want to wrap the thing I want to wrap up with you right now is that you said you had a brutal attack and you lost 6 of your teeth. I want you to go into what that was and how that happened and how that affected you. And I want to make sure I understand if it was when you were in the group home or before that, because eventually you transferred and you went to college, which statistically is fantastic. I know you both did, but I want to talk about that. And then I want to jump into Alexis's story. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it happened when I was 13 years old and I was living with my aunt. I was living with my aunt at the time. And what's funny is I think about maybe 6 months after that, I left her home. And I don't think she really considered that trauma or like that compounded trauma.
Yeah.
I don't think she considered that, thought about it too much. But it was about 6 to 8 months after that situation that I left her home. But it happened at 13 and just I used to catch the city bus home from school. So walk from school, walk about a block or two from school and then catch the bus home. But, you know, guys outside of school messing with kids, like I was in middle school at the time, high school kids, just messing with, you know, the younger kids in school. And they decided it was a thing a lot of times where they kind of like you just pick somebody randomly, beat them up or whatever. I think this time it went like a little too far and they hit me with a brick. It's just randomly. I didn't know the people or who they were. And then lost 6 of my teeth. and or four of my teeth completely, two partially damaged. A piece of my bone underneath my nose was partially gone, so I needed a bunch of bone graft, root canals, a bunch of surgery and everything that I couldn't afford at the time. And yeah, just years of dental surgery and dental surgery going wrong. So even more of my teeth started to rot and like just deteriorate after a while. And it wasn't until 2019, 2 years ago, where her adopted mom contacted, or we were talking, and I was vulnerable enough to share my story with her. And then she had an idea that popped in her mind that says, oh, there's an organization called Watermark for Kids, and I'm sure they can help you out. And, you know, I had so many people told me they could help me out. We even drove to Canada one time trying to get quotes to see if they could help me out with dental surgery. Because, again, my teeth are deteriorating. My front two teeth are fake, and just a bunch of dental health issues. And, you know, I reached out to them, not with any hope or faith in the situation, but I'm like, I'll just do it just because. And Alexis is like, it's going to work. It's going to work. Don't worry about it. And one day I'm actually in training or doing something, and they called me like, hey, we'll cover the full expenses of the dental surgeries. And it was like $25,000 altogether. Mm-hmm. And it was like, we'll cover the full expense. Don't worry about it. And I started crying. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, and literally maybe 2 months after the surgery, because it was like between 6 to 8 months worth of surgeries and everything, because again, my bone was missing and I was wearing like fake teeth. And 6 to 8 months worth of surgeries coming back and forth from the dental office. And 1 month after the very last surgery where I had the teeth that I have now, I got on stage in Atlanta at a gala in front of like 3,000 people, told my story and just encouraged a bunch of people. And it's actually in the book near the end of my narrative. And it was like, it's like a movie. I don't know. We'll turn this into a movie one day. yeah, it was crazy. Yeah.
How did that affect you emotionally? Because you had to keep taking the city bus. You had to keep, you were 13. That had to have been emotionally terrifying.
It was hard, but just like, you know, the culture is about just suppressing your feelings and pushing through. Okay. And that's just what I had to do. I had to just forget about it. You know, I had to walk in the same parking lot where I lost my teeth, was hit with a brick, had to go to the same school, kids making fun of you, making jokes about you not having teeth, kids walking up to you, telling you to smile in front of the whole school at lunchtime, kids watching you at lunch to see how you eat now. And it was real awkward and strange. And there was a lot of crying in the bathroom alone, but you know, you figure it out. And I think during this time, I blamed God. I was upset at the world. I was angry a lot. And I had to figure it out. And I just suppressed my feelings. And just, I think I was more extroverted at the time, but then I became super secluded, introverted, and stopped talking to people as much, and kind of did my best to try to fit in any way as possible.
So hard, so much trauma. Wow. Okay, so Alexis, I want to go into your story now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So really starting off, my parents were together, obviously, when I was born. But then about a year or two after I was born, my dad still, you know, denied me. So for the first basically 2 years of my life, my dad, my biological father, denied that I was his, and it was a hot mess. I was born with the last name of my brother's father. I don't know, that didn't make much sense to me of why my biological mother did that, but my biological father, he went to jail a couple times for possession and selling of cocaine. He was caught at work doing it, so he went to jail. He lost their home that he built for. I have a half brother, so it would be for me, him, then my mom and my biological father, and move back to Michigan. This all happened in New York, and then move back to Michigan. And my mom and dad were, you know, had a whole custody battles like this whole time. And it was a huge stressor and a struggle for both of them, I think. And I would go to my dad's on weekends. And I don't remember the abuse really starting with him. It was physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. And I don't think that that really started until my biological mother died. And after doing a lot of research from, you know, writing the book and other things like that and reading a lot of court documents, my biological father has a history of stalking from my mom and then his ex-wife. And I've heard several stories of coworkers and things where he would come into her job and sit in the corner, just kind of, you know, letting his presence known and scaring her. And about a month after he won the custody battle, she committed suicide. So, that was about sixth the time. And my dad, who, you know, he's still in trouble for cocaine and things like that. And I read the court readings where he would say, you know, basically blaming it all on my mom and why he's doing this. He's trying to provide for me and because my mom committed suicide and all these things. But it was just always scapegoating, always blaming other people for the issues. And I moved in with him full time. And that's when the abuse really started with him. And for about, I lived with him from like 6 to 13. And then it was the abuse and other things really picked up. Mainly the physical, well, I guess it was all of it. Physical, sexual, and emotional abuse for at least, 7 or 8 years. Until one day it got the worst that it happened where I came home late from a concert. And he essentially threw me up against the wall, dislocating my shoulder, throwing golf balls at me. And I was like bruised up. I couldn't feel my arm. It turned blue. And then the next day I went to church with a friend and her mom was a police officer. And my friend just blurted out in the car of what was going on. And the mom being a police officer obviously wouldn't let me go home and call the police, call the ambulance. And at that point I only went back after my dad was taken to jail to get a few belongings. And then left and I went and lived with my aunt and uncle who I never, ever, ever wanted to live with. And it was funny because I didn't want to live with them because my biological father talked down on them a lot. But then when I moved in with them, my aunt would act like the mom that I never had, you know, was acting super loving and supportive and really wanted to be there for me. So I thought maybe everything my dad said was a lie and, you know, I need to let that go and trust her. But then everything that I essentially told her in those first couple of weeks when I moved in, when she got mad at me a couple months later, she would throw it all in my face in private. And when she would get mad at me, she'd go down in the basement and grab a suitcase and throw all my stuff in it and threaten to kick me out or, you know, call the social workers. And it was just really like 5 years of hell living with her. So she's my uncle, which my biological uncle, that's his wife. And so I lived with them and their two kids for about 5 years, constantly begged my social workers to get me out of the situation. But none of them would because they're like, you're at a good school. You're in a nice home. You need to kind of find a way to make it work. And I was also at my 10th school. So I was like, they're not going to pull me out. And I guess, you know, because it wasn't physical abuse, it was more emotional abuse and it was in private. She never did it in front of anybody else. And it was always my word against hers. So I didn't really have a case, you know, to try to get me out of the house. But at the end of the day, I'm glad that I ended up staying there because I stayed at the same high school. And I was able to graduate, but then also, you know, in God's timing, everything happens for a reason. And when she did kick me out my junior year of high school, she threw all my stuff outside, told me to come pick it up. And I was terrified. I didn't know what to do, where I was going to go. She always threatened that I was going to go to some worse family or I was going to be put out of state or whatever. So I had really no idea what was going to happen, but I had a social worker who really, really advocated for me and said, Alexis, I have the perfect family for you. Just be patient. And I mean, I had no choice. So I was patient for about a week or so, stayed with a godmom. And I met literally the most amazing family on the planet. I love them to death. I've known them for about 10 years now. And I was adopted at 26 by them. Oh. And the greatest people ever. I found my forever family because of the situation. So in the order of things that happened, I wouldn't change it because it made me who I am today. And I met my forever family. And then also, you know, because they went to Western Michigan University, I decided to go visit the campus. And when I visited, I fell in love with it. And then also I met Justin on the first day of our scholarship program.
Right. I know. We're getting there. So, wow. I want to make a comment about emotional abuse, because I remember as a kid thinking, just hit me and get it over with. Because it was so much easier to get hit. It's so much easier. Like, yeah, you bruise, but like then it's gone and it's quick. But emotional abuse is just exhausting. Mm-hmm. And also you can't quantify it. If you hit me and I have a bruise, I can show you like this is the result of what you did. But when someone is emotionally abusive, you can't, there's no way to show this barometer of how much it hurts you. Mm-hmm. And because it's so internal, it's really much more difficult to work through. So that is excruciating that you went through that, and terrifying. And then at the same time, I understand the social worker's perspective, having worked both sides, you know, so it's awful. It's just awful. How sad. Mm-hmm. You guys both went to college because you just let it slip that that's where you met. So like statistically, and I'm so happy that they adopted you at 26. I have a daughter that came to me at 9 and pretty much aged out, and she's 32 and she's still like, I wish the state had just let you adopt me. They never terminated. They kept trying to reunify and it never happened. And you know, it drags out that they don't really care really about terminating at a certain point, because like you're older and you're safe, so they have a lot worse fires to put out. But I mean, every time she brings it up, I'm like, if you want me to adopt you at 32 and that means a lot to you to have that piece of paper, then I'll adopt you. Like, let's submit the paperwork and do it. I don't need that paperwork to know you're my daughter, but I'm totally on board with doing it. So it's really awesome to hear you were adopted at 26. That's
my parents said the same thing of, you know, I don't need the paperwork. Are you sure you want to go through that? But also she was saying it as like a money aspect, because they're like the most frugal people I've ever met. I'm telling you, I fit in right with them because I am so cheap. So I'm like, I am your daughter, really. And so, but I was like, you know, there's something so like final about, you know, me being your daughter. Like, yeah, I need that. It's like closure. I needed that for myself, versus like, there's always this open-ended thing. Like, you could kick me out. You could disown me. You know, it's not that you would, or I think you would, but it's a possibility. It's there. Versus now it's like, no, I can't. I wanted that.
You wanted to be stuck together. And I do get that. I do get that. So you guys beat the odds. You go through all of these situations. And Justin, you went from the group home into college, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you end up both going to Michigan State.
University of Michigan.
Western Michigan.
Sorry. U of M.
We met each other at Western Michigan University. Alexis
Western Michigan
went to University of Michigan Flint first, and then she transferred to
there we go. Yep.
Okay, so that's why I messed it up. So you were both scholarships. Tell me about that and getting there, and how frightening it was to be on your own. I know, Alexis, you had support now from a family that was great, but still, there's trauma that's residual, especially emotional. So walk me through getting into college, the scholarship program, and then how you met.
Yeah. So for me, college was more or less about getting close to the person I was in a relationship with at the time. So I was in an 8-year abusive relationship from 13 to 23-ish. And so he's in Flint, I'm from Flint, and it was like my way of getting back there, because all the way through high school, I lived about 50 minutes away. So it was my way of like finally making it back. And I had this huge grudge that I was taken away from the city that like I wanted to go back to. And I finally made it back there. But then the abuse just got so much worse, like skyrocketed when I moved there. And it was just constant punishment, and just it's just getting so much worse. And so for my first 2 years of college were very much like just navigating an abusive relationship and just looking sane. I'm a great student. Like, that was just always given for me, that I can excel academically. But for me, that was my coping mechanism. Like, for me, my education was the one thing nobody could take away from me. So I'm going to excel at it. That's like my one thing that's mine. But the abusive relationship really started to interfere with that. And so I started skipping classes. I couldn't function. I was just laying in bed crying all day. And so that was for my first 2 years of college, was just trying to make it every single day. And I felt like my brain was at its maximum capacity at all times. And then when I transferred to Western, I thought, you know, a different, you know, I thought maybe like getting him away from his friends and out of this environment and how Flint became so toxic and all these things, I thought it would help, like a change of scenery or something. But literally I just brought the situation to a new city, and it just skyrocketed even more. I didn't think it could get much worse, but, when I transferred to Western, he came with me. And then, but after about a semester or two, we broke up. And then, but that was after I studied abroad, on my second study abroad to South Africa. And I was gone for about 5 months, and came back. And then about 2 or 3 days later, I ended the relationship because it was just getting like so much worse. And I ended it, and I almost got evicted from my apartment. And I think for myself that I would have left the relationship a lot sooner if I knew that I had like kind of a way out, I had somewhere to go. And my parents called me and were like, Alexis, why don't you just come with us? And I was like, well, I didn't know it was an option. I wouldn't have never asked. And so essentially I was able to cancel my lease before I was evicted. And I moved in with them and for the summer and before I started that next semester. And probably, it was exactly 7 days later, I joined the CETA Scholars Program at Western. And that was on the first day was when I met Justin. So 7 days later, I met Justin on the first day of that program. So I really think it was, you know, me cutting ties to the thing that was holding me back for so long and allowing my faith in God to take me to that next step. And it was just like, here he is. No.
Now, which one of you guys was waiting to be in a relationship? I read something about that. Was that you, Justin?
I don't know if I was waiting to be in a
relationship. Well, was me.
Oh, waiting as far as like.
You didn't want to get into one yet, but surprise.
Well, because my parents asked me not to date for a year. And I was that. I don't want any guy ever again. I was like, I want independent Alexis. I'm good. And then I meet him.
Okay.
No, I think we still waited a few months.
We did wait a couple months.
And then I think I was still a little hesitant because I was like a freshman in college and I still wanted to live that college life, so to speak. But I wanted my cake and eat it too. I didn't want to meet somebody, you know, who was like amazing for me and just like an amazing person. But at the same time, I still wanted to, you know, just being honest, I wanted to mess with a bunch of girls and live that lifestyle. And I couldn't have both, but I feel like I made the right decision.
Made the cut. What was your dating life like, Justin, when you started to navigate relationships on your own? Because often we go right back into the same abusive relationships or we become the abuser. So what was your experience in dating?
So I guess throughout my teenage years, I wasn't like, I got away from like childhood habits of being like, abusive and I would say abusive, but yeah, just like abuse and privacy. Like when I was a 7 to 8 year old, it was like kind of the theme to like go and touch girls' butt and try to get their attention and call them out their name, just trying to mimic the adults and the older people we saw in our lives. But as I became a teenager, I maybe matured a little bit. I stopped doing that, but I still wasn't I still tried to live a life or be a person I wasn't by just trying to mess with a bunch of different girls and do a bunch of things I saw other people do, being like a ladies' man through my teenage year and college years, but it wasn't me and that just wasn't who I was. But even when I got my teeth knocked out, I mean, I became like I would say completely different person, but I just reeled it way, way in where like I didn't really talk to too many people. Because again, my teeth were fake. And when I played football from 9, like actually the year I entered foster care, I played football from 9 to like 17. And when I played football, I needed to take my front 2 teeth out because they were fake and I didn't want to break it. Which first time when I got my false teeth, I actually broke them because I was playing football with it and I didn't want to take them out because I was ashamed. And then I super glued it together, which is a whole other story that I never really, I didn't put in the book, but I super glued them together, which is stupid. And then they broke again. But so I went through that process of being kind of ashamed of who I was and my teeth and everything. And football players on the team were kind of making fun of me. Like, you'll be walking down the hallway in school, like, hey, no teeth, hey, gap, you know, all these jokes and everything. And you kind of like, don't really want to talk to girls because it's like you in a hallway trying to talk to somebody and then you get a football player or a teammate like, hey, yo, teeth, what's up? And then you kind of explain yourself to this girl you're talking to, like, hey, what do you mean, no teeth? And then the guy walk up like, hey, take them out real quick. And imagine you being in school trying to talk to a girl and your teammate is like, hey, take your teeth out right now in front of everybody. And it's just like, it became weird. So throughout my high school days, I wasn't really dating or out there as much. But when I graduated, I started to try to mimic, you know, friends and try to be that guy, like no relationship, just mess with a bunch of girls. And that's who I thought I would be going into college. And then I met Alexis. But then I still need to go through the process of figuring out who I was and spending time alone and everything. It's reconnecting with my spiritual practices and reconnecting with God in general. So I needed to go through that process and find out my identity, who I was. And then I noticed it wasn't about sex or messing with a bunch of girls, but more about satisfying God and serving God. And I think that's when I was able to flourish in my relationship the most, especially with Alexis and individually.
Absolutely. Those are really, really hard things to work through for people older. So like you were at a really young age trying to navigate all that and make decisions. And so that's huge. I mean, I don't think we stop and pause and look back and give ourselves enough credit for when we take the right direction or the better direction or the, because a lot of the time it's tougher because being a ladies man and playing the college life is not hard. There's nothing hard about that. I went to college. So like, there's nothing hard, but it's not necessarily best.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That was a lot. How difficult was it for both of you guys we've talked about abusive relationships and staying out of that and not being abusive. We've touched on a little bit. What about the drugs and the alcohol and poverty? Because that's not just a situation, it's a mindset. How hard was it to not want to use those things that you saw around you to escape? Because definitely when you're going through abusive situations, the desire to escape is pretty strong.
So what's interesting though is like, say even for us, we had to go through individual journeys of healing and self-discovery to come together, yep. Right? We had to go through that. And that's exactly why we split even our book into two narratives, where we didn't write the entire thing as one voice or together, because we had to show people that we had to do that individually. And I think what so many people do when they seek out relationships is they seek out somebody that's going to fill those voids or heal them or save them. And for us, we had to figure this out on our own. And that was also the beautiful part of it, is that we both don't drink. We both don't do drugs. Like, that was something that we both individually decided on our own. And for me, when I was in that abusive relationship, the person I was with, he had an alcohol problem. He smoked weed every day. He hid stuff from me. You know, it was a lot of these issues and tendencies that I saw from my childhood. And I think for myself, I knew that I didn't want that going forward and I wasn't going to do that, but I put up with dating somebody that did that. But I told myself, you know, after that relationship, the next person I'm going to be with, and I'll be okay with never finding, you know, never finding someone and being by myself, but I'm not going to settle for somebody that drinks a lot or smokes a lot or whatever. But looking at the friends that I had at the time, all of their partners, that's what they did. It was constantly drinking and partying and smoking and stuff. So I thought, I'm never going to find somebody that doesn't do those things. I'm just going to have to accept that. And then I met somebody who doesn't do those things along with me. So it wasn't a battle. It wasn't constantly, you know, the constant arguing or trying to convince each other to not do it. But it's also being super intentional that when we are stressed out, that we're not going to things that run in our bloodline. You know, addiction is in both of our bloodlines. So how can we make sure that we're holding each other accountable? So like when we have a headache, can we get through it? Or do we need medication? Probably we're going to push through it. You know, it's things like that of how can we every day make decisions to where we're not, I guess, subduing ourselves to those different, you know, decisions that we could you know, overcome in some other way.
I hear that. People, when I was in college and I wasn't drinking, I've never smoked a cigarette. I've never done a drug. You know, I wasn't drinking at all. And people were like, oh my gosh, you're so strong. And I thought, you don't understand. It's not strength that makes me not do those things. It's fear of what I could become.
Exactly. That's exactly
right. And like, I guess you're strong because you don't do it, but you don't understand. When you see someone who's a raging, violent alcoholic and you're around drugs and abuse, physical and emotional, I was so terrified of becoming that my fear kept me from never trying things and experiencing things. It wasn't my strength. Mm-hmm. And so, Yeah. And, you know, with my kids and the addict, like I knew I genetically was predisposed to be an addict. I was born to addict parents. Mm-hmm. So my kids that have been adopted or in foster care, I'm real clear, like you're genetically predisposed to be an addict. So I think everybody should be very cautious because addiction's so prevalent in our mm-hmm. society. You need to be a little extra cautious about it because you're genetically predisposed to it mm-hmm. also. And real clear because there's nothing that they've done wrong. It's mm-hmm. just like the nose you have and the color of your eyes, you just have that.
Your ACEs assessment. What mm-hmm. Adverse experiences had you had, whether it's something that you experienced yourself or it's just been around you. It's the environment that you live in. It's what's something that's been normalized. Mm-hmm. And for us, my ACEs score was a 10 and Justin was a 9. So we knew right off the bat after taking that it's like, all right, we have a lot of crap that we got to work through individually. And we have to be even more intentional before we decide to have children to make sure that we're not passing those things down.
Mm-hmm. It's real. I mean, that's like, we could go down the rabbit hole of how fascinating that whole conversation is. You know, it's very fascinating for me. And then the nature versus nurture and all of those things.
Oh, yep.
I want to talk. So we're at college and you guys have met. So I want to go back up to that point. Who, what, when, where, how helped you? You know, like I look back at my life and I think someone said something or did something to me or something happened or there was something I read that was kind of like a drop into your brain that made a positive difference. And you might not recognize it at the very moment, but later mm-hmm. you look back and you're like, wow, when that person said that to me at 15, that was significant. There was a shift internally that I didn't realize. What things up to this point made a really significant positive difference in your lives?
Mm-hmm. I would say, I was in that group home when I entered the group home around 17 years old. So the group home was structured where there was for four boys aging out of the foster care system, and they had two house parents there. But the group home was funded by the church, and the church provided mentors, they provided tutors, a driving instructor, and I have a funny story to go along with the driving instructor thing where first time they let me drive, I put a huge like scratch on the side of somebody's car, and I still feel bad for that person. I still feel bad about that situation. But they helped me get my driver's license, Spanish tutors, like everything we needed was provided. And it was basically like a community helping us to get us where we needed to be. And I think I'm one of the only boys from that group home who's going to college, but just that environment in general was just amazing and helping me get to the college and speaking life into me, seeing other African-American, seeing other Black people, Black couples, Black successful men, Black successful women, just speak life into me. And like, you can go to college, you can be successful. And saying that with ease too, like, what are you doing? You know, you can be successful. It's easy for you. And it's like, sometimes I went to school because at that point I had like a barely a 2.0 in high school, and they're speaking life into me, and I'm like, wow, I really can do this. So I went to school and started working hard, not even for myself, because I just didn't want to let them down. So I started mm-hmm. working hard in school and trying to fulfill the promise that they said to me, and then working towards that, and that eventually got me to college, and it eternally had a bunch of weight on my shoulders to where I need to be successful for my family and for the city of Detroit and all this. But it really just encouraged me to want to be successful for myself and stop the generation of abuse and show other people that it's possible to stop the generation of the culture and generations of trauma that's being passed down. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Oh, I love that. So the group home was actually a really, really good place for you.
Yeah, for me, I mean, it's a bunch of group homes that are not as a good of an environment where a lot of abuse occurs and everything. But this group home specifically, it was spiritually based, funded by a church, supported by a church, and something similar to this, I would say, I would support. I mean, of course, I want youth with actual families, but for me, I was either going to that group home or a detention center. So I chose the group home all day. So,
but I mean, that's awesome. not to say that there weren't a lot of things that happened in the group home that definitely made like a negative impact. But I think, you know, the takeaway overall could be positive. For myself, I would say through high school, it was definitely the teachers. And that was another reason why, like, I kind of stopped giving up or started giving up on, you know, calling out for help for my social workers to help me move. Because when my aunt was constantly threatening to that I would move out of state or whatever, I was afraid to leave that school because I had my huge support system was my teachers. I had lunch with them every day. Like I wasn't eating with students. I was eating with my teachers, or I was hiding away in the counselor's office. They had like a little side room that I was always in, and I could do my work in there. I could kind of sit in there and teachers would send me my work, and I could stay in there all day if I needed to. So my school, obviously why my education became my coping mechanism, was because that felt safe to me. And then I met my, you know, foster now adoptive parents. So that they have played fundamentally the biggest role in my life of helping me change my entire dynamic around how I see God, how I see relationships, how I see marriage and raising children and all these things. Like, for example, I never knew that you could parent without smacking, hitting, yelling, beating your kids. Like, I didn't know that it was a reality. Like, that seems so normal for some people, but like, that in every home that I've ever visited with friends and things growing up, it was always that. That's a shared narrative. We had that. And then when I went to go, you know, moved in with my foster parents, like, they didn't do any of that. And I was like, you guys are weird. Or I thought their kids would grow up weird, but really it's a loving home. It's healthy, you know, and I never knew what that was. And I'm still constantly blown away for things. Like when I go over there and just seeing how life can be healthy if you choose for it to be, but you have to know the signs and what that looks like. So having exposure and being able to live in that environment changed everything for me.
I didn't meet I call him my adopted dad. He didn't actually adopt me, but he was the only dad that I ever knew that was a positive influence in my life until I was 19. And he died 11 years later. And all I can say is, like, it's never too late. And, you know, when I met the family, I thought, I'm just waiting because they can only pretend for so long.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes.
Right. I was 19. Yes. I was in my second year of college and I'm like, there's no way this is what it's like. And I'm just going to sit back and wait and watch because eventually it's going to fall apart. Right?
You say that because I actually read in the book that my parents thought that I didn't like them because when I first moved in for the first like week, I stayed in my room. Like I wasn't trying to, you know, get to know them or anything like that. I was just observing. Because I want to know, you know, is this going to flip up? Are you guys actually crazy? Or, you know, like I didn't know. But then also knowing from living with my aunt and how all that information that I share with her, how it, on the back end, it came out against me. I wanted to, you know, witness that. And so it's interesting that you also mentioned that, because I noticed a lot of youth who've experienced trauma is we're also observers. That's what we do. That's a survival technique. Is to observe your environment and those around you to see if it's safe. So I like that you mentioned
right, because
that.
Then you know what your escape plan is.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know how you're going to react. And people that don't understand that. And then you hit a point where you realize, oh, they're not fake. Like, this is really who they are, which is so weird. You said that's so weird. I was like, this is perplexing. I just don't understand it. And then, exactly. Then you learn that it's normal. And then you realize how unhealthy that things were, and then you love it and you embrace them. And like, that 11 years I had before he passed away, I am so grateful I had that time to understand how men should treat women and children and families. because I hadn't seen it. So, and so I want people listening to realize that if there's an older child being placed, or it's not ever too late. It's just not ever too late, right? I want to kind of wrap up and end. You guys met and you waited a few months. You held off a few months. You denied that you were going to end up together. But you knew, you knew you guys have a lot in common drawing you together. So take us through from meeting until now and what you're doing now and who you work with and how, what that looks like. And leave us with like whatever positive message you want to leave us with.
Yeah, I would say, even though you could be in a relationship, you can be around other people. We always tell youth, we tell individuals to find the happiness is a process that takes place internally. And that even though when we got together, I relied a lot on Alexis for my happiness, for so many different things that, you know, I started to be in a situation where she became my crutch. And we always talk about this conversation that we had where, you know, she started going to counseling and then she encouraged me to go to counseling as well. And I'm like, I don't need a counselor. I got you. And then she's like, no, I think you need a counselor. And it's not, there was like a huge issue that was happening, but just for like family history and always feeling bad about pressure from family, she just encouraged me to go to counseling. So always be able to identify the individual that you are, even in a relationship, in a group, in your career. Always try to understand your identity and who you are outside of that, and try not to ever lose that, because your partner, your career, and any and everything that you do shouldn't be able to dictate your identity and who you are. Only you get to choose that. And again, happiness takes place internally. Contentment takes place internally. Outside resources like a house or anything physical or anything that should contribute to your happiness, but it shouldn't ultimately be your happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to, you know, alluding back to your question where basically, you know, we dated for like 4 years and then we got engaged. He flew out to Ecuador when I was studying abroad. We studied abroad 13 times between the two of us.
Wow.
And, yeah, so it's been a lot. And on one of them, you know, he flew out and proposed to me the first day that he got there, and waited 2 years to get married. And what's funny is that it was during COVID, but it's all good. I was able to, right before that, get adopted. So my dad walked me down the aisle. That was something that was big to me. And then we got married, he graduated, we published our book like 2 months later. And then the next month, and so we published our book in November, bought our house because of the book and its success. We were able to buy our first home. So, you know, that's something that we've been able to do. And then, you know, now here we are with all the craziness going on.
I love it. Oh my gosh. I love it. And I love that you guys took your time and that you supported each other on your individual journeys and the journey of you two as a couple, because that should be how things are navigated in all relationships. And the more trauma there is, I think the more true that is. What positivity? Well, first, how can people find you and how do you work with people? Are you speaking and getting word out and helping that way through the workbook? Are you working with specific agencies or individuals? What does that look like?
So we are doing it all, really. We're doing it all. We are collaborating with organizations. We're collaborating with youth serving organizations. We're doing workshops, keynotes, presentations. And if anything, we're giving our products, like our workbook, our actual book to them, so they can go through the healing process. They can go through redefining their normal. They can go through process of shaping the culture for themselves and the next generation. And people can find us at re-definingnormal.com. It's our website. Contact us through email at info@re-definingnormal. Facebook is Redefining Normal Movement. Instagram and TikTok. We're on TikTok. Is
what? Okay. Where's my phone? I have no idea where my phone is. I am going to find you on TikTok.
We're trying to keep up with the young folk, you know.
We're trying.
We also want to show like more of a personality, more of our fun side, things we do.
Yeah.
Sometimes we got to force ourselves to go do something fun just so we're not sitting in front of a computer all day. And we're on TikTok, re.definingnormal, and Instagram as well, re.definingnormal. And we want to invite everybody to join the conversation and join the movement, because this is bigger than ourselves. This is not just about myself and Alexis, but everybody has a normal to redefine, whether you're in foster care or not, whether you have serious trauma or not. We want to challenge you to redefine normal in one area or capacity of your life. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can reach out to us on our website, re-definingnormal.com. Email us, info@re-definingnormal.com. That's where we do our bookings as well.
And I put all of those in the show notes. Everything should be in the show notes for people too. So in the description, and I've tagged you guys everywhere that I can. Would you like to leave with something positive that you would pass on?
No, we don't want to leave anything positive.
Good, perfect. We're just gonna flog this horse of negativity. I'm finding you on TikTok right now. I stalk you everywhere else, so I know.
If I could leave with something positive, I would say now I gotta come with some cliche motivational quote, like change the world and you can do it and follow your dreams. Listen, kids, follow your dreams. I'm joking. What should I say? I mean, it's a lot of things we can do or say, but really, once you are withholding your passion, your gifts from the world, you're robbing the world of inspiration. And, you know, when we produce our gifts and talents, we're producing fruit for other people to eat, to grow and develop their children and their family. So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for being on. Hang out with me for just a minute. I'm gonna do the outro, and then I have loved this conversation.
No, thank you for the invitation. It means the world to us, and we're happy to be able to hop on and talk to you.
Thank you for investing your time with me on At a Crossroads with the Naked Podcaster. I'm so glad that you joined in the conversation. It would be amazing if you would share this episode with someone you think can benefit from it. All guests' links and audience freebies are available on the podcast page of momof18.com. This podcast was designed to help you in your struggles. So reach out and let me know what you enjoy and what you would like to see more of. It will support me on the journey to causing a worldwide epidemic of healing, gratitude, and joy. Until next time, remember, you're not alone in your struggle. Reach out to me on any platform. I love to connect. You are worth it to me.